It's 8:08. Good morning. I'm Leslie Thatcher. It's the KPCW Local News Hour. Stay tuned. Coming up, I'll be talking with Matthew Weinstein, State Priorities Partnership Director with Voices for Utah Children and University of Utah economics student and principal author of this report, Mario Ramirez Arizola, talking about the report that shows the cost of not including undocumented workers in the COVID-19 stimulus programs. Then Christine Coleman, Communications and Marketing Director with the Park City Community Foundation, talks about the decision to move forward with this year's Live PC, Give PC. And then finally, Summit County Health Department Director Rich Bulla has the latest update regarding COVID-19 and the reopening of schools here in Summit County. Stay tuned. Well, Summit County schools are opening this week and next in the midst of a pandemic. How that teaching and learning is done, whether it's in school or online, depends on how well students follow the guidelines to stay safe. KPCW's Rick Bruff reports that school reopenings were the major topic during Tuesday's conversation with the Summit County Council.
During the electronic meeting, County Health Director Rich Bulla said the county's mandatory mask order has led to an impressive decline in cases in the last month and a half. But he said that the situation can change with events. Bulla said he anticipates there will be an increase in cases with the reopening of schools. But he said schools aren't the only reason for that. He noted that looming in the next few months are Labor Day, flu season, and the opening of ski resorts. Bulla and council members also stressed that school reopenings are not their decision. Those decisions are coming from the superintendents and school boards, though he said the county is contributing input and has a strong relationship with the districts. Councilmember Doug Clyde cautioned against using a simple word like safe.
The return to school is, quote, safe. We have no ability to tell you whether returning to school is safe. In fact, all the data would indicate that returning to school has substantial risks. It is up to the school board to determine whether those risks are acceptable or not. That is not our responsibility, nor do we have the expertise to make that determination about whether the quality of your child's education is paramount to the point that a less than completely safe, again, quote, safe environment is possible.
Bulla said to make schools safer, you can take significant preventative measures. Those include social distancing of 6 feet and avoiding interaction for sustained periods of 15 minutes or more. Bulla said it's incredibly important to use face coverings.
My strong belief is, and this is based on data, the best hope for keeping schools open, just like keeping businesses open, is stringent use of face coverings. And it's not just within the classroom. If athletic teams want to be able to compete for a season, they need to take this seriously. Face coverings mitigate the risk. They reduce the spread.
He said no one is talking about closing schools, but he noted that the state epidemiologist, Dr. Elizabeth Dunn, is preparing data-driven standards to determine when a class should go to remote learning. The standard would reportedly be if 3 positive cases emerge in a class. In a school, the standard would be 15 cases or 10% of the student body, whichever is less. During the conversation, a few callers asked Bulla or council members if they supported the reopening policies of the Park City School District, which are reportedly to have students back full-time in person. Council Chairman Doug Clyde had this reply.
And the answer is, we're not the educators in the room. The educators are the people who are making this judgment. We are doing what we can to provide them with information that we have and our expertise. But the safest thing to do is to lock yourself in a closet and get fed through a straw. That's really beyond our scope to make those sort of decisions.
Council member Roger Armstrong also said that they can't tell the districts what to do.
Anything we can suggest, we can beg, we can plead. And in the case of Park City, they have a strong school board and they have strong opinions about the way they want to do things. And I suspect that if we walked in their door and said, we want you to do A, B, and C, they would probably show us the door and provide us with instructions about how to get out. So we try to pick our battles where we need to pick our battles. And right now, there's nothing in front of us that requires us to pick a battle.
In response to a question from Armstrong, Bellow said that so far he had not seen any procedures by the school districts that raise a giant red flag. Armstrong said the question of returning your child to school is very difficult. Parents who stay at home to care for their kids can be economically impacted. And Clyde said the continuing operation of schools is integral to a normal life for many citizens. For KPCW, I'm Rick Broth.
A report issued last month calculated the cost of leaving undocumented workers out of the first wave of federal and state COVID-10 stimulus plans. The report was authored by University of Utah Economic Studio Mario Ramirez Arzola and was unveiled last month in a virtual meeting hosted by Matthew Weinstein, the State Priorities Partnership Director for Voice of Utah Children. Both men join me now on the phone. Good morning.
Good morning.
Hello.
Matthew, why don't you just start and tell us, why was your organization interested in this data that Mario provided?
Well, as we all know, we're in an unprecedented situation with the pandemic and with the economic impacts of the pandemic. The federal government has played its appropriate role. It stepped in quickly and effectively in March to ensure that local government, state government, that residents, that the unemployed, that everyone, at least we thought at the time, was going to get the assistance they needed to deal with both the health impacts and the economic effects of the pandemic. But one thing that we pretty quickly realized was that actually a substantial number of people were left out. And that's the title of our report, Left Out, Adding Up the Cost of Excluding Undocumented Utahns from State and Federal COVID-19 Relief. And so if I could turn it over to Mario, he can talk about the main findings of the report.
All right, Mario, why don't you go ahead and tell us some of the highlights then?
We were kind of seeing how much immigrants are kind of paying into the social welfare of the community here in Utah, and seeing what they didn't get back from it. So I believe the big number we ended up finding was that they were being denied $154.4 million in state and federal relief aid. And that number is composed of many other ones, the stimulus payments for the children, the enhanced unemployment insurance, the regular unemployment insurance, and the stimulus payments for the kids. So, yeah.
So what kind of economic impact has it had then on our Latinx community, because they didn't get the stimulus funds?
A big... Go ahead, Mario.
It's definitely had a big impact, I think. The Latinx community isn't that well showcased here in Utah for obvious reasons that a lot of them are perhaps undocumented. But, you can see it have ripple effects in the community. And, as we had on our press conference, I believe, I think it was Amy and Alexandria who provided their stories of how they were suffering because of the pandemic and not getting any help from it. Yeah.
Did you want to add?
Yeah, if people go to our website and click on the link, they can actually see the details of the stories that we heard that were really moving, from Alexandria Taylor from Salt Lake City and Amy Contreras from West Valley City, who were both completely left out of both the unemployment insurance and the stimulus payments because even though they themselves are U.S. citizens, they're the head of household in both cases were undocumented immigrants among the roughly 100,000 Utahns who are undocumented immigrants, which is, nearly 3% of our state population. And as a result, their families had to struggle through the pandemic, through the economic impacts, being laid off without getting any of the public assistance that so many Utah families have taken, as a lifeline in this extraordinary crisis.
Yeah. Mario, can you give me just a little bit of backstory? How did you get involved? Why was this something that you wanted answers to?
Well, I'm personally in the Latinx community, and all my life I've been around the Latinx community. Particularly happens to have a lot of undocumented folk in the community, obviously. Just from friends, from family friends, I could see a lot of them reeling from this impact. And I wanted to get a kind of quantifiable perspective on this issue because people were having kind of pragmatic opinions about this whole thing. But I wanted to kind of put it on paper. And
And then tell me, I mean, is it something though that the Latinx community would have wanted? I mean, doesn't it sort of put a target on their back if they're undocumented? I mean, they take the money or perhaps risk deportation or no?
Well, that brings up the issue of public charge, where, you know, the Trump administration has changed the public charge rule for immigrants, where immigrants, even who are here legally, which is, of course, the majority of immigrants in Utah and nationally, are penalized now under the public charge rule, where if they access government benefits like these, that will be held against them and used to make the case that, well, you're not self-sufficient. You're not someone who you're going to rely on the taxpayers, on public assistance, and therefore you're not going to be allowed to remain in the U.S., to become a U.S. citizen eventually. And that, you know, is not a smart idea in the middle of a pandemic where you want people to stay home from work when they're sick. You want them to get unemployment assistance. You want them to access public health resources so they don't spread the virus. And the public charge rule is discouraging families from doing that. And at a time when we're seeing the Latino community generally in Utah, which is the home of most of Utah's immigrants, being hit with sort of a triple impact, where they make up 14% of the population of Utah, but about triple that percentage as a share of all the COVID cases that we've seen in Utah.
Yeah. So, Matthew, where do you go with who? Where do you go from here? I mean, what do you do with the information in Mario's report?
So we're sharing this information with state and local governments. And we're asking state and local government to step up and fill this gap. This is a population that is so vital in Utah, not just culturally, economically, making up a disproportionate share of essential workers. And we're asking state and local government to fill this gap, at least begin to fill this gap, starting with the $4.5 million out of the $154 million that was intended to go directly for children, since we're Voices for Utah Children. And so we've been discussing this with local county governments, including Summit County, Salt Lake County, Salt Lake City, Park City, and urging them to set aside some of their local resources to begin to fill this gap.
Yeah, so something like this, though, has happened in other states, is my understanding, in terms of local government kind of stepping in. Can you give us an idea of what that looks like?
Yeah, Mario, do you want to share a little bit about that?
Yeah, well, in our paper, we showcased the states California, Connecticut, Colorado, Oregon, and Washington, which all have at least some sort of measures because of the COVID-19 pandemic that were at least trying somewhat to be in direct aid of the undocumented. There's a lot of examples. For example, Connecticut, they had a $2.5 million rental assistance program for those who were uneligible for the CARES Act emergency assistance. So that would include undocumented residents and just things like that, basically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So.
And it's important to keep in mind that undocumented Utahns are taxpayers. They are workers. They are contributing into this system that's financing this assistance. Yet they've been left out of receiving the aid when it's so needed.
Yeah, again, I guess that goes back to my question, though. I mean, do they really want it? Again, given what you've told me with, you know, the federal policy, that is it worth it?
Well, the states that have done this, such as, for example, California, which is providing $75 million in disaster relief assistance for undocumented adults who can apply to receive $500 per person in direct assistance, they have set it up in a way that it does not count toward the public charge rule. And that's very important. Two things are very important when this aid is set up by local governments and by state government. One is that it does not count against the public charge rule. Second is that it needs to be publicized widely among the impacted community. That's one reason why we're working with Comunidades Unidas and other Latino-based organizations in Utah, so that when this aid is made available, which we hope and expect that it will be in the coming weeks and months by local governments, it needs to be publicized through the immigrant community so that people will be aware of it, will know that it won't be held against them for the public charge rule purposes, and so they can get the help they need.
All right. So you've had good response then from local leaders in Summit and Wasatch County here along the Wasatch Back?
So far, we've heard great intentions, and we've heard an understanding of the problem. And now we are counting on them to step up and appropriate the funds so that Utah and local governments can do their part to help this vital part of our community that's been left out of this assistance.
Doesn't anything need to happen on a state level, or is it it's easier just to work with the local governments?
Well, we're starting with local governments. They're closer to the issue. They understand the need. They, in many cases, do have the resources from the federal assistance that's come directly to and indirectly to the local governments. But we'd love to see state governments step up as well. The legislature is having a special session next week, and it's certainly not too soon to look at them next week and ask them to take some action to help these Utahns in need.
All right. Again, the report left out adding up the cost of excluding undocumented Utahns from state and federal COVID-19 relief is available in both English and Spanish on the Voices for Utah Children website. Can you give us that link there?
Terrific. Well, thank you very much for having us on, and thanks for covering the story.
Okay. Matthew, yep. Mario, thank you. Well, despite the ongoing fundraising the Park City Community Foundation has done since March 15th, when Park City businesses shut down and thousands lost their job, the foundation has made the decision to move forward with the 2020 Day of Giving and will be sponsoring once again Live PC, Give PC this fall. On the phone with details, I have the Communications and Marketing Director for the Park City Community Foundation, Christine Coleman. Good morning, Christine.
Good morning, Leslie. How are you?
I'm well, thanks. So what kind of discussion did the foundation have when thinking about whether or not to do Live PC, Give PC during the weirdest year ever?
Oh, my goodness. We have had so many discussions, and we are thrilled that we decided that Live PC, Give PC is definitely going to happen at a time when so many events have had to cancel. You know, the Community Foundation plays an important role in solving our community's challenges, and we exist to help ensure that Park City and Summit County are resilient. And one of the things that we do is organize Live PC, Give PC. We have done it, this is kind of amazing to me, for 10 years. This year is going to be our 10th anniversary. So when we shut down on March 13th, one of the first things we said is, oh my God, what's going to happen to Live PC, Give PC? Can we do it?
All right. And so you decided that you can do it because it's done virtually anyway?
Yeah. So one of the great things about Live PC, Give PC, it's, you know, our biggest event that we do, and it is primarily, that's where all the giving action happens. So that makes it a lot easier with COVID-19. For those folks who might not know, and I think there's probably a lot of newcomers who aren't really familiar with Live PC, Give PC, it's our community's annual day of giving. And this year it's on Friday, November 6th. It happens every year, the first Friday of November. again, organized by the Community Foundation, and we do it in partnership with over 100 local nonprofit organizations. It's really a key fundraiser for many of those nonprofits. And this year, because so many nonprofits have had to cancel events and galas, our hope is that they are really able to recoup some of the funds that they may have lost with Live PC, Give PC. So whether it's through the arts or education, healthcare, environmental efforts, or supporting recreational programs, the nonprofit community benefits really everyone, not just who lives here, but everyone who works here, plays here, and stays here as well. And we hope that the Giving Day is going to help stabilize the nonprofit community in this crazy year of COVID-19.
All right. So what you'll have to give up, though, is kind of like that end of day party. And then what, people on street corners? Will you still have that happen with the signs? And the
walking? So let me tell you what's going to change. Unfortunately, we do have to give up the end of day party that we've had at High West. High West is still going to be one of our big sponsors, but we can't have, 400 people squished in a room. We are still going to have people on the street corners and donation stations wearing orange. For folks who are familiar, you might remember seeing people waving Live PC, Give PC signs. And the name of the game with this is safety. We have Live PC, Give PC face masks this year, and everybody will be required to socially distance unless they're coming from one family unit that's already together. We're also doing some creative different things that we've never done before. And this is a change. Because it's the 10th year, we had big plans, Leslie. We were going to shut down the street and have a street party. We can't do that. But we are going to have a parade that winds through many of the neighborhoods and also gets into the outer neighborhoods. It should be a raucous, fun time with music on a flatbed truck, and we'll have a schedule that we'll give out to everybody a few weeks before so people can know when the parade's going to come through their community. We're partnering with Mountain Town Music to most likely have some music that will stay put in certain parks along the parade route. We will also have a live stream on the website, livepcgivepc.org, where folks can see people being interviewed, whether it's nonprofits talking about the impact of donations or sponsors. We'll also have some music and some fun things going on there right online. And we have a big focus on the neighborhoods this year, which we haven't done before. We really, really want to include everybody. That's the thing about Live PC, Give PC. It's a way for anyone who is part of our Park City community to get involved.
Okay, so you have had in years past big money goals. What are you hoping for this year, especially in a year where many are tapped out? Either they don't have the money to give or they've already given so much to keep their favorite nonprofits afloat during these last 5 months.
Yeah, so since the inception of Live PC, Give PC, we have raised over $12.7 million in those 10 years. Last year, we raised $2.4 million, a little over that, and we don't actually have a money goal this year. Of course, we hope that we will raise over what we raised last year, but our goal is really a participation goal. We want to get as many people as we possibly can to donate. So our goal is to have more than 5,500 unique donors, and please, we want people to spread the word and let all of the newcomers or folks who have never been involved in Live PC, Give PC, know that this is a really fun way for them to support our community.
All right. So who's kind of running it this year? Ollie Wilder's kind of been the guy in the past, but he left in June. Have you taken that on?
Yes. Yes. Well, as the marketing director at the Community Foundation, I am playing a big role in running it. We also have a part-time event manager who we ironically hired 2 days before COVID started, and she's helping out a lot. Her name is Ellie Cutting, and really our whole team helps out. It's a big lift for us, We also have the nonprofits that really get involved. We do different trainings for them to teach them a little bit of how to make the most out of Live PC, Give PC. And they do a lot on their side to promote the event, talk to all their donors, and make sure that people are signing up to volunteer.
All right. So what do nonprofits need to know now if they want to participate?
Well, the main thing they need to know, because it's a ways out, right? It's 3 months away. It's November 6th. But right now, our big announcement is that nonprofits need to register. Even if they have participated in Live PC, Give PC in past years, they need to register every year for this giving day. And registration is open online at the livepcgivepc.org website. They have to register by September 30th. And that's really what I want the nonprofits to do right now. They can also reach out to us and talk about creative ways that they can more deeply involve themselves in Live PC, Give PC than they have in past years.
Okay. Anything else you wanted to tell us about that?
Definitely. Just a couple things. Thank you to KPCW for always being a great media sponsor for us. And thanks to all of our other sponsors, including Vail Resorts up at Promise, Blue Sky Utah, High West, and many others. Sponsorships are still available. So if you're a business or a family who would like to take advantage of that, you can do that right now. Folks can start to do early giving on September 6th, so less than a month away. And I will say, if you can't wait for Live PC, Give PC to give, and you want to start supporting some of these nonprofits that have been hit so hard by the economic consequences of COVID-19, you can get donations matched this summer to 28 different nonprofits. The Community Foundation is matching donations to help stabilize the nonprofit community. And you can do that by visiting parkcitycf.org/givingguide, and you'll see all the options.
Okay. Christine Coleman is the Communications and Marketing Director for the Park City Community Foundation. Thanks for your time this morning.
Thanks a ton, Leslie. Have a great day.
Hi, this is Greg Cropper of Jones Waldo Park City. I've been a big fan of KPCW since its first broadcast back in 1980. Jones Waldo has been representing clients from Summit and Wasatch counties since 1875. You can find us at joneswaldo.com.
Well, a decision whether or not the town of Hideout will be able to move forward with their annexation of the Richardson Flat area of Summit County won't be made until Friday. Summit County officials say a decision against the county could have far-reaching consequences. KPCW's Sean Higgins has more on that.
Attorneys for Summit County argued at Monday's hearing a dangerous precedent would be set if Hideout is allowed to annex the Richardson Flat land east of the Victory Highway and State Route 248 interchange. The Hideout Town Council took advantage of a controversial piece of state legislation at their July 9th meeting, known as Utah House Bill 359, in order to begin the annexation process without consent from Summit or Wasatch County. Summit County Manager Tom Fisher tells KPCW the county is concerned a decision allowing Hideout to move forward with the annexation could negatively affect the county and have far-reaching consequences for other land issues across the state.
You know, we're always concerned about this. This certainly has huge ramifications to the county. Whether it goes through, whether it the judge decides in the county's favor, and Hideout is stopped from moving forward at this time.
The ultimate fate of House Bill 359 is in the hands of the Utah State Legislature at the August 20th special session. Summit County argues the process behind the passage of the bill was done in bad faith, with lobbyists for Richardson Flat developers Nate Brockbank and Josh Romney working in concert with state lawmakers to add an 11th-hour amendment to the bill that opened the door for Hideout's annexation move. Brockbank acknowledged meeting with members of the Hideout Town Council prior to the July 9th vote. Lawyers for Hideout argued that because those meetings were not with the full town council, the Utah Open Meetings Act was not violated, as Summit County alleges. Hideout also argues that they were well within their rights to take advantage of House Bill 359 as it was, and currently is, state law. If the court rules in favor of Hideout, the town council could vote to continue the annexation before the state legislature is set to reconsider House Bill 359. Fisher says this possibility makes a repeal of the bill an even higher priority and could open the door for more at-will annexations in the future.
We're keeping our eye on everything and keeping vigilant to this because of that. We have heard reports that the legislature is certainly considering a repeal, but we haven't seen anything definite yet that tells us that that's on their agenda.
Judge Jennifer A. Brown is scheduled to rule on Summit County's lawsuit against Hideout on Friday, August 14th. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Hi, I'm Julie Hopkins with Keller Williams Real Estate. I love our great community and all the amazing nonprofits that make it the fantastic place it is. And it's a pleasure to support the KPCW Local News Hour with Leslie Thatcher to stay up to date on the critical issues facing our community, as well as the human interest stories that are the heartbeat of our town. Real estate information, jhparkcity.com.
It's 8:41. Good morning. Well, the Snyderville Basin Planning Commission last night heard from a lengthy lineup of speakers arguing the pros and cons of the massive Dakota Pacific project at Kimball Junction. KPCW's Rick Bruff reports that the Snyderville commissioners did not come to a decision on the mixed-use project, which proposes nearly 1.3 million square feet and some 1,100 residential units.
During the meeting held via Zoom, the Snyderville Commission heard from about 20 speakers. The majority were against the project, but there was also a strong contingent in favor of the proposal, which would amend the approval for the Boyer Tet Park given in 2008. The critic said that, at best, it is a good-looking project in the wrong place, and the massive development doesn't belong in a mountain resort community. Opponents were also worried about traffic. They rejected the contention by the applicants and their supporters that UDOT won't give a priority to fixing issues at Kimball Junction unless there's a major node of density there. Miles Readyman said it's contrary to the visioning sessions that residents have held in the area going back 30 years.
People have fought against the urbanization of the Snyderville Basin. They talked about small town character. They talked about a rural character. It might sound quixotic, but collectively, we've taxed ourselves well over $100 million to make it not quixotic, to save open space and to build trails and to keep it a fair low density kind of place. So when I think of having to have density just so we can have transportation, it seems like putting the cart before the horse. I think what this represents, quite frankly, is a capitulation to a vision we sort of voted down over and over again. And I always called it Murray in the Mountain.
Another critic, Kathy Mears, said that affordable housing can already be found at Silver Creek Village, which is building 330 units, the Canyons with a planned 1,100 pillows, and other projects. She also noted that the developers are presenting a slick, attractive image of the project.
Beautiful style development if you live in Denver, if you live in Salt Lake City, if you live in some developing community. We live in a mountain resort community. Okay, that's inappropriate. I see absolutely no reason for this proposal to be moved forward. I'm very against it. The long-term transportation concept, okay, you're going to need it, but here's the thing everybody's saying. UDOT won't even look at us till we have such a horrid, we have so much traffic problems, they won't even consider it. We already have a big traffic problem, and they don't think that's enough.
But among the supporters was Jeff Smith, who said he was on the Snyderville Planning Commission when it approved the Boyer project.
I was there and often would leave those meetings wondering if I would be proud to say I was part of the approval. 3 weeks ago, I drove through the development and wondered whatever happened to that research park we approved. Now I know it died, not to be revived. The market and trends in that niche of commercial real estate simply refuse to move up the mountain. And I understand almost everywhere in the country, developments such as this research park are failing, being redeveloped or sitting as empty as ours is. We need a new thought to secure the benefits suggested in the original proposal. To refuse to consider an amendment to the plan is to stick our heads in the sand and ignore the economic realities of the marketplace. To reject them out of hand is just simply foolish.
Finally, Angela Moschietta said the project is smart development and the opposition to it stems from NIMBY or last settler attitudes.
Frankly, I don't care what was or wasn't in the plan before. The plan was made for a different time and a different set of challenges that the community never rose to. We are ground zero in the ski wars and, like the rest of the world, confronting a pandemic and declining snow. And Kimball Junction is not a mountain community. It is an unincorporated suburban gateway situated along one of the busiest highways in the country that looks upon a mountain town being crippled by traffic, a lack of housing, and a declining workforce. Big and Bold is embracing smart development and working together to address our current challenges and mitigate against future ones. It is considering the community we can be and not binding ourselves to a bygone era. In conclusion, I fully support Dakota Pacific's proposal and encourage everyone in Summit County who plans to be alive and here for the next 40 years to wise up to the solutions that affordable, walkable, transit-oriented development offers.
Angela Moschetta. The Snyderville Commission continued discussion of the project to their August 25th meeting. For KPCW, I'm Rick Brough.
Support for KPCW comes from Noah, who believes that a modern approach to home financing starts by building a strong partnership with homeowners and their most valuable asset, their home. Learn more at noah.co.
After you spend time connecting with a friend, you might check back in a few days about how their ankle is doing or how that cake turned out. Following up, it shows you listen and that you care. On Morning Edition, we do the same by sticking with the issues and people making news so you can find out what happens next and why it matters. Stay in touch with Morning Edition from NPR News every weekday.
KPCW News Time now, 8:47, still waiting for Summit County Health Director Rich Bola to give us a call in. Well, the Federal Bureau of Land Management has canceled a planned sale of property in southeast Utah to be used for oil drilling following opposition from county and municipal officials. The Spectrum reporting that the land between Arches and Canyonlands National Parks will not be included in the September sale. The agency says it will offer more than 42 square miles of property to purchase during the week of September 28th, but will not include the parcels within the Grand or Summit counties. Grand County Council and Moab City Council wrote to the Bureau seeking an end to that sale. And the Summit County Council has a rather light agenda today, but as part of its meeting, it will consider important steps on items like trailhead enforcement and the wrap tax. The council will be convening in an electronic meeting starting at about 3:30 today. One of the first items is a proclamation declaring American Wind Week, saluting wind power renewable energy for August 9th through the 15th. Later on the agenda, the council will consider a resolution for the reauthorization of the wrap tax for another 10 years to be put on November's ballot. The Recreation Arts and Parks tax is 0.1% sales tax. The revenues are split between uses for the arts and recreation proposal. The ballot proposal is being called an opinion question, but Summit County Manager Tom Fisher said that the council is still legally obliged to respect the result.
The state law calls it an opinion question, but according to the, again, according to the attorney's office, the council can't go against the opinion. So it is just a little nuance in state law, but I suppose that there might be some way that the council may not adopt it, but according to the attorney's office, they have to follow the opinion of the voters.
Fisher acknowledged that the county has placed signs along some of the local trails, giving notice that they've been financed with RAP funds. However, Fisher said that once the council approves the question for the ballot, council members and other public officials cannot be advocates for the tax. He says they can only pass on factual information. The RAP resolution, he says, has to be approved at the latest by next week in order to get on the November ballot. At about 5 o'clock today, the council will consider an amendment to the parking code, which says that the highway authority can authorize a party or agency to enforce the parking code. Fisher said this is the second step, which allows the Snyderville Recreation District to regulate parking around trailheads in the basin. That's being done to mitigate neighborhood impacts and to ensure emergency road access in areas like Summit Park. Fisher said that the highway authority is the council.
It's one of the county council's roles, similar to a meeting as the governing board of one of our special districts. They are the highway authority, so anything that happens on county right-of-ways or roads they have to act as the county highway authority in order to make those things legal.
That's Summit County Manager Tom Fisher. Well, a Utah tax watchdog group and a former member of the U.S. Nuclear Regulatory Commission are calling on cities to pull out of a planned nuclear power plant project before it becomes too expensive. The Deseret News reporting that the carbon-free power project is promoted as the next generation design for nuclear power, but critics worry the small modular reactor design is unproven and not cost-effective. The project called NuScale is backed heavily by the U.S. Department of Energy, which gave a competitive award of $226 million in 2013 to develop the technology. Heber City is one of the cities that is considering participating in this project. Well, the Early Childhood Alliance will be hosting several virtual events in the coming weeks centered around getting kids back to school and educating parents on the value of early childhood education. KPCW's Sean Higgins has the details.
Originally formed as a task force on early childhood education for the Park City Community Foundation, the Early Childhood Alliance is focused on providing children in the Wasatch Back equitable and abundant opportunities from the prenatal stage through their third year. The Alliance is also part of the ongoing social equity work between the Community Foundation and Park City Municipal. Kristen Schulz is the coordinator for the Early Childhood Alliance and says early childhood care is about much more than just providing a safe place for children while their parents are at work.
This is also a social and economic justice issue. When we look at the data, there are significant disparities in kindergarten readiness that are based on income, minority status, and English language fluency. And so one of the outcomes that we're really trying to change by our efforts is to make sure that all of our kids are kindergarten ready by the time that they are, you know, of age to go to kindergarten.
The Alliance is funded through the Early Childhood Fund at the Park City Community Foundation and has about $750,000 to spend on programs this year. Schulz says they estimate about 1,800 children in the Wasatch Back could be helped by the services, as well as up to 1,000 children of out-of-town workers who commute to the area each week. The Alliance will be holding a virtual back-to-school roundtable discussion at 1 p.m. on August 18th to answer questions from parents wary about sending their little ones to school in the midst of the COVID-19 pandemic. Brandy Rasmussen is the director of Creekside Kids Academy and Peak Program and says much of the back-to-school discussion so far has been centered around older students.
Just like the elementary schools, there's parents to have a lot of questions and there's a lot of unknown. So we're all dealing with those challenges, and I think that's going to be one of the big benefits to having this panel discussion is parents are going to get the opportunity to figure out and learn what we're doing and how we're moving forward.
A recent report by National Public Radio says at least 97,000 children tested positive for COVID-19 in the last 2 weeks of July. Schulz says the decision to send young children to pre-K is ultimately up to parents, but adds she believes the benefits of early childhood programs will be hard to turn down.
I think when you look at the data overall, though, the overwhelming benefits of being in a high-quality childcare environment are powerful. And then you also have the issue of, you know, the workforce issue. It is very difficult to work at home with a toddler. And, you know, childcare, I think a lot of people may not think about this, but childcare is really a two-generation workforce issue, right? Because it's essential to support your workers who actually are working today, the parents, but it's really also vital to developing our workforce for tomorrow.
Schulz adds that all of the associated childcare providers are adhering to strict health guidelines as the school year approaches. The Early Childhood Alliance will be holding a fundraiser on September 22nd, and additional details will be provided as they become available. For more information on the Alliance or to register for the Back to School Roundtable, visit earlychildhoodalliance.net. Sean Higgins, KPCW News.
Taking a look at some other local news now, South Summit School District is the first Summit County School District to open for the 2021 school year. And the superintendent says the district is as ready as it can be, navigating uncharted waters in this midst of this pandemic. Parents and students at South Summit were asked to register for one of three different learning options this year. The district is offering 100% online, homeschool, and a classroom hybrid. Superintendent Chad Sorensen says the majority of students will be back at school today. Preliminary estimates show that 70% of students are choosing the in-class hybrid model, with the other 30% either doing homeschool or online.
At our South Summit schools, we're doing a 4-day in-class, 1-day blended learning option. And then at our Silver Summit Academy, we're doing 2 days in-class, and then the remainder days blended learning. And then we have a online option that is through the district, and then of course parents can choose homeschool if they want to go that route.
He says they will do their best to create socially distant, friendly classrooms.
In our school plan, we acknowledge that we would do our best. We're moving out furniture that isn't critical to the curriculum. We're spacing the desks as much as possible. But there may be situations where students aren't at the 6-foot distance. We are requiring masks per the governor's executive order, and students will be facing forward as much as possible. And then we've got personal protective gear, plexiglass dividers, and things like that that we're putting into place for those situations where the student and the teacher or the paraeducator need to be face-to-face to be able to serve that student appropriately.
Sorensen says they surveyed their teachers about how they'd like to return to the classroom, and the district is doing its best to honor those wishes. He knows not everyone is comfortable with the choices.
I wish I could say that there wasn't any faculty concern at all, but everybody is concerned about their family members at home, whether they're taking care of aging parents, whether they're taking care of immunocompromised family that live within their household. Everybody worries. And we don't have all the answers. And so there is always a little bit of doubt, not only for your own personal protection, but for those that you care about.
The idea behind no students at schools on Wednesdays, he says, is to be able to go into the schools and do a deep clean every week. The schedule also offers some last-minute backup if needed.
We wanted our faculty and our students to be able to work with the curriculum online, work with the programs, and then to be able to prepare on Monday and Tuesday for that, then come back on Thursday and Friday and address any of those concerns and those issues so that both teachers and students, if we have to go with minimal notice to more days at home or half the students at home, that we're going to be able to do that seamlessly rather than the challenge that last spring brought to us.
That's the superintendent of South Summit Schools, Shad Sorensen. Again, the first day of school is today. Due to new growth, the district will have to bring in a portable classroom for this school year, although he says it hasn't arrived yet. The school board now moving ahead with its master planning. He says they're considering whether to build a new school at the base of Promontory in Silver Creek and whether they can sell off any of their existing property to use proceeds for capital and building projects.